Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Monday, March 21st, 2016. This is a moment I've been waiting for a long time.
Remember when your brothers loved you and cheered as you walked down the streets of the great city? Where are your brothers now, Fidel? In a friendly land to the north. Why, that's the greatest fantasy of all, Fidel. Are they really happy there? Having left their homes and families? Fidel.
This song is from the Peter B. Collins Tax Deductible Music Archives. It dates from 1971. The California-based funk band called War, that originated as the sidemen for Eric Burdon after he left the Animals. And this song has always haunted me, because I like it. I like the music. I like the feel of it. It's called Fidel's Fantasy. But I never cared for the lyrics because Papa D. Allen, the lead singer who delivers the spoken word parts here, is taking a political position against Cuba and against the revolution that was sparked by Fidel Castro. And it was that part that I was never comfortable with. And today, Fidel's fantasy has been achieved. Because a president of the United States flew in on Air Force One yesterday and met with the successor to Fidel Castro, his brother Raul, as we approach normalizing relations with Cuba after the failed Cold War policy of trying to isolate it with sanctions, the embargo. We lost. And it gives me, you know, a certain level of satisfaction to know that Fidel Castro lived to see this day. Now, he's not involved. Clearly, the protocols that were put in place will not permit any meeting between Fidel and Barack Obama. But I really think that this is an important moment. And I don't see this as some celebration of a loss by the United States. The real victory here is that Barack Obama saw the failure, acknowledged it, and changed our policies. But in too many cases in other parts of the world, he has not been willing to change failed, long-running policies of the United States. And it's that contrast that I'd like you to think about today. Because I am pleased that we are changing these policies. But at the same time, we're attempting the same games against North Korea right now. And I'm no apologist for Kim Jong-un and his trigger-happy missile launches and his claims that he's got a usable nuclear weapon. But these tactics by a superpower don't always work. And we believe our own media, our own propaganda, our own righteousness. And we believe that we have the right, sometimes the responsibility, at least some people think that, to impose our values on other nations. And that's really at the heart of what is a cordial but testy exchange between Raul Castro and Barack Obama today in Havana. Now, they went through all the pomp and circumstance. Raul Castro pointedly didn't show up at the airport to greet Obama yesterday. But, you know, they reviewed an honor guard and a Cuban band played the national anthem and Obama, the U.S. national anthem, and Obama praised their rendition of it. But beneath this, Raul Castro has a pretty strong agenda and is willing to be pretty pointed with Barack Obama. Quote, "There are profound differences between our countries that will not go away since we hold different ideas on many subjects, such as political systems, democracy, the exercise of human rights, social justice, international relations, and world peace and stability." He continued, "We defend human rights. We consider that the civil, political, economic, and cultural rights are indivisible, interdependent, and universal." He then criticized the U.S. on a number of fronts. Quote, "Actually, We find it inconceivable that a government does not ensure the right to health care, education, social security, food, development, equal pay, and the rights of children. Wow, is he campaigning for Bernie Sanders? And he went on. We oppose political manipulation and double standards in the approach to civil rights, which might have been a veiled reference to Guantanamo. And then he lifted any veil. He said that he wants Guantanamo returned. He said, return the territory illegally occupied by Guantanamo base. Now, let me be fair. In the run-up to Obama's arrival, those who protest and are dissenters or dissidents against the government in Cuba were rounded up, detained, or silenced, and it is still an authoritarian government. I don't have any misgivings or any illusions about that. But President Obama has made, I think, one of the most important steps in foreign policy in his presidency. And I remain critical of his Middle East policy, the dissembling, the double talk that we've had over Syria, Iraq, and so many other conflicts, the use of drones, his surge in Afghanistan. I could go on. But the two signal foreign policy achievements are the opening with Cuba and the agreement with Iran. Today, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee begins its annual conference in Washington, D.C. And in advance of it, in Saturday's New York Times, there was a full-page ad that was presaged by a report that I brought you on February 3rd. I cited an article in the Jewish national paper called The Observer, written by Rabbi Shmuley Boteach. And Boteach runs an organization called the World Values Network, and they spent, I think it's about $50,000 to buy a full-page ad. The Saturday paper is a little cheaper than the Sunday paper. And it reads with an ugly rendering of Hillary Clinton, and mugshot-style picture of Max Blumenthal next to his father, Sid Blumenthal. And let me relate, if you don't know who these people are, Sid Blumenthal is a longtime, He's a toady of the Clinton family. He's been part of the Clinton political operation since the 90s. And his son, Max, is a journalist whose work I really respect. His book, Goliath, is on my shelf right over there next to his subsequent book called The 51-Day War. And Max Blumenthal is not anti-Semitic. He acknowledges that he is anti-Zionist and that he opposes many policies of the extreme right-wing government of the State of Israel. But in this ad, Shmuley Boteach says Hillary Clinton must disavow her anti-Israel advisors. Now, first of all, Max Blumenthal has never been an advisor to Hillary Clinton. It's his dad. He gets $10,000 a month from the Clinton Foundation, and we know that he peppered Hillary with almost daily lengthy emails about various topics. And in some of those emails, he included segments from Max's book and articles that he has written. Some of those are cited, quoted from the emails released by the State Department in this slimy full-page ad in the New York Times. But what is really insulting is the conflation of the term anti-Zionist with the term anti-Semitic. So, it reads here, even more shocking still were Sid Blumenthal's attempts to feed Hillary Clinton toxic analysis from his son Max, a self-declared anti-Zionist and fanatical Israel hater. This rotten apple did not fall far from the tree. In articles his father sent Clinton, Max Blumenthal, an active supporter of the anti-Semitic boycott, divestment, sanctions movement, revoltingly compares Israel to Nazi Germany. His book Goliath is full of references to Israel's Nazi mentality, Israel's Judeo-Nazis, and the Israeli army as Nazi SS. And I fully support those descriptions, which are, you know, quoted out of context from Max Blumenthal's book. But this is really disgusting. I mean, first of all, Hillary Clinton has been so loyal to Israel. As Secretary of State, she did criticize the settlements, and there were times that she had disagreements with Netanyahu. But she and Bill Clinton have always been strong supporters of Israel, and she continues in that vein. Now, we'll get to her remarks at AIPAC in a minute. But first, I have linked to a powerful op-ed that was written by an American rabbi, Brant Rosen. He formerly ran a synagogue in Chicago, but he resigned in protest after there was pushback because, you know what? He invited Max Blumenthal to talk to his congregation. Now, Rabbi Rosen is no longer running that synagogue. He works for the American Friends Service Committee. And the article that he posted is about the University of California's discussions, deliberations over a new so-called statement of tolerance, which, as he accurately notes, actually achieves the exact opposite of its stated goals. And it is an effort, a bald-faced effort, a brazen effort, to suppress free speech at the University of California, limiting the rights of both faculty and students to speak up in a critical way of the state of Israel and in support of the rights of the Palestinian people. And I want to quote from Rabbi Brant. "It is true that some anti-Semites lurk behind the label of anti-Zionism, and when they do, they should rightly be exposed and condemned. But it is deeply problematic to label anti-Zionism as a form of discrimination. In fact, growing numbers of Jews and others identify as anti-Zionists for legitimate ideological reasons. Many profess anti-Zionism because they don't believe Israel can be both a Jewish and a democratic state. Some don't believe that the identity of a nation should be dependent upon the demographic majority of one people over another. Others choose not to put this highly militarized ethnic nation-state at the center of their Jewish identity. Far from being discriminatory, their beliefs are motivated by values of equality and human rights for all human beings. Blurring the distinction between anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism muddles the definition of anti-Semitism to the point that it becomes meaningless. This conflation is irresponsible and harmful, and invariably draws our attention away from real anti-Semitism, whether it be the targeting of Jews, the vandalization of synagogues and cemeteries, or the proliferation of hate groups at home and abroad. Certainly all forms of racism should be called out in no uncertain terms, but erasing the lines between anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism only makes this task more difficult. And he says it's part of a larger strategy to ban Palestinian solidarity groups from campuses across the country. He says this would have a devastating impact on Palestinian activists and their allies and would prevent many Palestinian and Israeli human rights advocates from speaking on college campuses." One more quote. "Having long worked in the Jewish community, I know that some Jewish organizations equate anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism because they seek to protect Israel's image or because they don't want Jewish college kids to have to tolerate criticism of Israel and Zionism. But we shouldn't confuse uncomfortable with unsafe. Forbidding debate and free speech will not create more comfortable campus environments. It will only marginalize students for legitimately expressing their beliefs." Right on, Rabbi Rosen. By the way, I'm trying to track him down to see if I can get an interview for an upcoming podcast. So yes, while Bernie Sanders declined to speak to AIPAC, which is interesting as the first Jewish potential nominee for the American presidency, he was too busy on the campaign trail, and I'm glad to hear that. But Hillary Clinton showed up, and to my knowledge, the news accounts don't show that she disavowed the Blumenthals. But she did hammer Donald Trump without mentioning him by name. And Trump has said he wants to kind of position himself as neutral between Israel and Palestine to see if he can pull off the biggest deal of his life, as he puts it. And she attacked that, just like Ted Cruz does. "We need steady hands, not a president who says he's neutral on Monday, pro-Israel on Tuesday, and who knows what on Wednesday." She says, "Well, my friends, Israel's security is non-negotiable." And she told some touching stories about sitting in Israeli hospital rooms holding the hands of men and women whose bodies were torn apart by terrorist bombs. "That's why I feel so strongly that America can't ever be neutral when it comes to Israel's security or survival. We can't be neutral when rockets rain down on residential neighborhoods, when civilians are stabbed in the street, when suicide bombers target the innocent. Some things aren't negotiable, and anyone who doesn't understand that has no business being our president." Now, I don't see any difference between what Secretary Clinton is saying and what Ted Cruz is saying. And I find this amazing because essentially they are saying that they will embrace Israel's foreign policies, really, and give them higher priority than our own national interests. And this I find deeply, deeply problematic. Clinton also said, and I consider this hypocrisy, if you see bigotry, oppose it. Because as Max Blumenthal has pointed out, the Israeli government has official policies of bigotry against its own Arab citizens in the State of Israel and against the Palestinians in Gaza and the West Bank. It is a form of racism. It is apartheid in the policies that are established to promote those so-called values. Pandering further, Hillary Clinton also said we must repudiate all efforts to malign, isolate, and impugn Israel and the Jewish people. And that was a veiled reference to opposing BDS, boycott, divestment, and we know that we have the right to direct our dollars along with our values. And yet we're being told that Israel trumps, and I'm sorry, but I don't mean the Donald there, but Israel trumps those rights that we have as Americans. A quick footnote. I don't know if you've ever heard of Meir Dagan. He was a longtime leader of Israel's spook agency, the Mossad. He died last Thursday at the age of 71. And it's interesting because his obituary reads, Israeli ex-spy chief - bane of Iran. And that is true. He was a sharp critic of Iran, was very hostile to their regional aspirations. But after he stepped down as the chief of Mossad in retirement, Dagan publicly criticized Benjamin Netanyahu and his defense minister Barak and their policy of preparing for a military option against Iran's nuclear program, telling an audience at a conference in Jerusalem that a strike on Iran's nuclear installations would be a stupid idea. And it is so rare for a top Israeli general to speak out critically in that manner. And I will always remember him for that. Every day I like to pause and thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. I keep little lists of names, people who just contributed at PayPal. I want to acknowledge that Rex Wetzel from Indiana, he describes himself as a blue dot in a sea of red. He just renewed his annual subscription. Thanks, Rex. Great to have you with us for another year. And let me also mention here, who's on this list here? Gary Batterson, he kicks in $20 a month. Thank you, Gary. I really appreciate that. And Terry Paris, she is just a dynamo. I want you to join them. Come on over to peterbcollins.com today and grab a new subscription. $5, $10, $20 a month. Our best deal is the $50 annual subscription, and while they last, I've got bonus books, 3 titles for you to choose from. New Confessions of an Economic Hitman by John Perkins, The Burn Pits by Joe Hickman, and a fun book about the F-bomb, The Field Guide to the F-Word by Ben Parker. Those are available to new subscribers in the continental U.S., so I hope you'll jump on that today. Also, I want to thank the almost 1,500 people who have supported NewsBud to date. This is the new independent and publicly funded media outlet that we're planning to launch later this year with your support. Come on over to NewsBud.com. We've got 23 days left to meet our ambitious goal, and we very much need your help. So please spread the word and do whatever you can to help us. Well, it's really getting annoying because the New York Times has been exposed, and I thank Matt Taibbi for the work that he did last week, where he showed that an article that appeared on their website was modified later in the day without any notations, and it sharply changed the tone of the article about Senator Bernie Sanders. And they're still at it. In Saturday's paper, the headline reads, Despite setbacks, Sanders forges ahead with jabs at Trump. And the subhead reads, A campaign insists that it's merely the midpoint in a contest that will end in June. Now, that's actually a fact. We are at the midpoint in a contest that will end in June, and the Times characterizes that as something that they're insisting on as if it isn't true. Now, it's also true that for Sanders to win the nomination, he has to win increasing percentages in the remaining states. And it's not a foregone conclusion that he will win. But it is also not a lock at this stage that Hillary Clinton has it wrapped up. But that is the spin that the Times is embracing and that's coming from the campaign and being amplified by surrogates. So here's an article today in Politico. Democrats to Sanders, time to wind it down. Well, this is a really condescending piece where they quote all of the known supporters of Clinton, Senator Claire McCaskill of Missouri, Senator Jeanne Shaheen of New Hampshire, Senator Barbara Mikulski and Barbara Boxer of Maryland and California, respectively. And these are people who are all in deep for Hillary. They are not, independent observers. They're not just, neutrally watching this process and say, may the best Democrat win. And it's really insulting to those of us who want to see a fair contest, want to see it through to the end, and are not willing to capitulate and give in to Hillary's spin about her inevitability and some sense of entitlement. When she wins the nomination, I will acknowledge that. But she hasn't won the nomination, and this is really an insidious performance by corporate media in this country to mislead the voters who aren't paying much attention. And in the same vein, you may have heard a couple of weeks back, I made a big exception, and I brought on a listener, Gary Kane, gave him about 10 minutes to make his case. He's the one who called me a petulant progressive. And it's getting annoying, because over the weekend, Gary took to Facebook, and here's part of his post. I'm a Bernie supporter, but I'm getting tired of hearing an HRC bashing for the first 15 minutes of every Peter B. Collins podcast. She may well be the Democratic nominee, and all of us will have to put our criticisms aside and unite behind her. Does anyone want a President Trump? I'm troubled that Peter may go the Nader route again. He's gone too far out on the bashing HRC limb to pull it back for the election. Well, once again, Gary, you use the term bashing to describe honest criticism of the policies, the rhetoric, and the campaign posture of a candidate for president. And I do understand that the Democrats who are asking Bernie to tone it down and get out of the race, they are worried because they believe Hillary has the nomination, is entitled to it, and they remember back in 1988 when it was the Al Gore campaign that first introduced Willie Horton in an attack ad on Michael Dukakis in the primaries. And then the Bush campaign picked it up in the fall. Actually, it was the Reagan campaign, sorry. And, made a big deal out of the release of the felon Willie Horton while Dukakis was governor. But this is really offensive, Gary. Who are you, the self-appointed enforcer of Democratic loyalty? And haven't you listened? I am not a Democrat. I have not taken any loyalty oath to support the Democratic nominee. And so, one of our listeners, thank you, Kate Ann Brennan, posted to Gary, hey, go troll somewhere else, please. Peter doesn't bash Clinton for 15 minutes every show, and while Bernie isn't perfect, your criticisms are way overboard. And Gary Kane's response was, Kate, will you support the Democratic candidate, whoever it is? Get a grip, Gary. Get a grip. Donald Trump is once again defying the evidence before our eyes and claiming that, of course, it is lefty agitators who are messing up his rallies and causing violence. And in Tucson on Saturday, I do want to note that I object to the anti-Trump protesters who blocked access to the rally site. They blocked a roadway into it. And they may believe that they're performing a nice act of Gandhian civil disobedience. And I support it on that level. But in this context, it only gives fuel to Trump and his mob allies to blame the left, to blame those protesters for the violence that is repeatedly committed by members of Trump's staff. And on Saturday, the cameras caught Corey Lewandowski, his campaign manager, grabbing the collar of a protester who was being escorted out by a security guard. Trump says, no, he didn't touch him. And nobody, you know, the media will play the fact, the video that's pretty clear, and then allow Trump to say it didn't happen that way. And this is a real problem. His willingness to lie is almost pathological. And if you haven't seen it already, I hope you get to see John Oliver's takedown of Donald Trump on the wall on the border with Mexico. On his HBO show last night, he did a magnificent job of hitting all of the false points. Number one, that Trump lies about how much it would cost. It's somewhere between $4 and $20 billion, but it's always shifting. And Oliver noted that even if you could build a wall and seal off the Mexican border entirely, which isn't physically possible because of the Rio Grande River and other features, you wouldn't cure the immigration problem, because at this date, nearly 50% of illegal immigrants in this country are those who came in at airports. They didn't swim the Rio Grande or climb a fence in Arizona. And that shows the basic racism of the appeal to immigration, or the failure of our immigration policies, by Trump and his followers. Now, the effort to stop Trump over the weekend, there was some further meeting in Washington. And this is bizarre, because I do understand why the Republican establishment leaders feel that Trump is stealing their party. He's going to take it for a joyride and then leave the car cracked up in a ditch, out of gas, and walk away from it. But their idea of derailing Trump is to revive the candidacy of Rick Perry, the failed former governor of Texas who can't remember three departments he wants to shut down, or former Senator Tom Coburn, the Bible-thumping reactionary from Oklahoma. They think one of those guys could win as an independent, or, you know, by dumping Trump at the convention? Wow, man. It's hard to keep a handle on all this. I got a few items in brief here before we wrap up. I got to see the movie about Steve Jobs over the weekend. I thought it was pretty interesting, too narrowly focused on his personal life and his relationship with his daughter, Lisa. Also saw the movie Trumbo. I recommend that. Bryan Cranston is an amazing actor. It's well written, of course, about a blacklisted film writer from the 1950s. I do recommend both films. But speaking of Apple, researchers at Johns Hopkins University were able to crack the encryption of the Apple iMessage service, proving that a skilled attacker, or the FBI or NSA, is capable of reading messages sent between iPads, iPhones, and Macs, despite the security measures that Apple has put in place. So today they're releasing iOS 9.3, and they say that will fix the problem. The Supreme Court declined without explanation, as usual, an appeal of a case that came directly to the court brought by the states of Nebraska and Oklahoma, challenging their neighboring state Colorado's legalization of recreational marijuana. They argued that the law allowing marijuana was against federal anti-drug laws, and said that it was spilling across the borders, complicating their own anti-drug efforts, and the Supreme Court was unmoved by that. It's interesting, the Obama administration weighed in favor of Colorado, even though Obama won't take the step that's available to him to reclassify marijuana down from Schedule 1 in the Drug Enforcement Act. Warning of mission creep, and I've been talking about this as we watch Obama's lame duck year, and as all the attention is on the Trump circus and the presidential race, watch out for mission creep. So, last weekend, an American Marine was killed in Iraq near the town of Mosul. And according to Marines.com, the U.S. is sending a detachment of Marines to Iraq following that deadly attack that left one Marine dead and eight more injured a couple of days ago. The Marines and sailors are with the 26th Marine Expeditionary Unit. We are told no numbers of how many Marines and sailors will be deployed to Iraq, but we're going to see this. An incident will occur where an American is captured or killed, and this will be the excuse for almost invisible escalation. Just ratcheting it up a little bit, and a little bit more. And you may have heard that a plane that was flying from Dubai to the Russian city of Rostov-on-Don, crashed and killed all aboard. High winds were blamed. Now, a couple of tantalizing tidbits have surfaced, and I can only report what I hear from Russian media and from the EU Times newspaper. We have multiple sources here. And that is that the plane that crashed was carrying a, quote, high-level American Central Intelligence Agency official. Now, this is a female individual who is traveling, we're told, on a forged British passport using the name Larissa Allen. That's all I know. The other tidbit from this airline crash is that in the cargo hold were suitcases filled with cash. In fact, $27 million in U.S. currency. Now, we can't necessarily connect this alleged CIA official who died on the flight with the $27 million. But I don't know about you. I'm curious to know more about that story. Thanks for joining me today for my Monday News and Comment. Feel free to share this far and wide. I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until